We'll move on to item number six, discussion and possible action on the report from our technical consultant, Ryan.
Are you driving?
Sure.
Sorry, good morning, everybody. Just for the new members, I wanted to reintroduce our team. My name is Ryan Lundeen. I'm with Half Associates out of the Woodlands office. And I have here Jenna. She's been vital on this project as well, working under me. And we were the technical consultant last cycle, and we're honored to be the technical consultant again this cycle of flood planning. We actually have several of our team members who joined us today, and we'll be presenting some of the relevant tasks. But we have Evan and Jacob with Torres Associates, we have Connor with Holloway Environmental and Communications, and we have Nick with Breeze and Nichols. And we also have Susan Roth, who helps us with some public outreach coordination, but she wasn't able to make it today. But I'm the project manager for this study. So for the agenda for this meeting, I apologize, it is a little bit lengthy, but we're kind of in the midst of a bunch of different things. So it's just kind of the nature of where we're at right now. But I want to give you all some general updates, what's happened since the last meeting. I want to give you an update on the community questionnaire that we just closed out a couple weeks ago. Connor's going to give us an update on the public road show and hopefully finalize a plan for our public outreach meetings that we're going to be doing later this year. And then we'll be doing an update on task 2B, kind of some of the homework that we did, some of the data that we found and looked at and finalize our future conditions flood risk approach at this meeting. And then we're going to introduce two tasks today, task 3A, which is the floodplain management practices, and then task 4A, which is the identification of FMXs. You can go to the next one. So just on a general update, I wanted to show you all where we're at in the schedule. As always, a red line is where we're at today in May. And as you can see, we started task 1 through 3A. We'll be kicking off task 4A today. We've gotten all the available data from Texas Water Development Board. So we did receive that data, FATHM data from Texas Water Development Board. And we did close out our community questionnaire. Jenna will kind of cover the results of that in a bit. And what I'm trying to do over the next couple of months is start delivering y'all chapters to review. So we'll be providing a task 1 chapter for y'all to review in July. And then after that, we'll have task 2 and then task 3. And the goal is to get y'all a draft technical memo to review that sums up all the tasks that we've performed on the screen, tasks 1 through 3 in November-ish. And then so that y'all can review it and provide comments, we'll bring it back in December for y'all to do a final vote so that we can then submit that to the Texas Water Development Board early next year. So that's kind of the main goal that we're shooting for, by trying to tier this so that we don't give everything to y'all at once. So just some really high level updates. We're just continuing to work with task 1. We're developing the chapter as we speak and finalizing some analysis as it pertains to just kind of overview of the region. Task 2A, we are still gathering models for this effort. This is the existing flood risk quilt that we're developing. We have the process in place. We know the procedures we want to take, but we are waiting for a few models, particularly the GLO model or GLO models. Once we get those, that's kind of the critical piece. We'll be able to start quilting together a flood risk layer for y'all to review in a few months. And then we did get the future FATHM data, or what we call the cursory floodplain data for future conditions. So we did get that. We've looked through it, and Nick will cover that during his 2B review. We did finish the community questionnaire, and I'm going to let Jenna give an overview of that.
Yeah, so as y'all might remember, we sent out the questionnaire originally earlier this year in January. And we sent that out through a master email blast to our full contact list for all communities with flood planning interest within our region. And we sent a couple of follow-up community blasts in March to remind people about the upcoming deadline and encourage them to fill it out. And then we did close out the questionnaire at the end of April. So we gave people about 4 months to complete it. And in that 4 months, our team performed a lot of personal outreach to follow up with over 100 entities and really just stress why is the questionnaire important, and offer them any support they need to log in and complete it and get it done by the deadline. So kind of some background on why we care and why we, you know, formed this outreach and really pushed for people to complete the questionnaire. A lot of the information we gleaned from this questionnaire really informs the development of several tasks throughout the planning process. So as you can see, just these general categories of the different questions that were included and what tasks they support. So as we introduce each of these tasks and talk through them, we'll bring back some of these responses and kind of give y'all an overview of the input we received from communities and how that might inform our decisions going forward. And you'll see an example of that today with Torres's presentation on task 3A. But in the meantime, if y'all want to look through all of the responses we did receive, we provided some supplemental documentation that summarizes all of the questions. And kind of looking at who did reply. So we did shorten the questionnaire quite a bit from the previous cycle. We had received some feedback from communities that the questionnaire last cycle was too much. It required a lot of effort to complete, and entities have a lot on their plate. They don't have time to spend hours providing us with responses. So we truncated it to about 20 questions and one interactive map. And we got good feedback on that. 90% of people who opened the survey completed all the questions, which indicates it was approachable and a reasonable ask of communities this time. And you'll see we received about 45 responses. Over half of those were municipalities. But we also received a really good showing from the counties. Almost half of our counties provided a response, which gives us really good coverage throughout the region. And then we also got some responses from these kind of other flood planning interested entities, which includes drainage districts, LIDs, MUDs, councils of governments. And those really helped fill in some gaps where we didn't get responses from the municipalities and counties. And kind of looking at that same information geographically, you can see that we got quite good coverage throughout the region. So these green polygons on the figure on the right show all the counties that provided a response to our questionnaire. And the blue polygons show the other entity types that provided responses. So you'll see that big blue polygon on the right is the Middle Brazos Council of Governments, I believe. And so they covered a lot of area and represented a lot of population with their response. And then these yellow-orange kind of pins represent all of the entities that responded. And another really encouraging metric is these responses represent about half of the population within the region, about 1.7 million people. So we did hit a lot of these major municipalities and the counties that really picked up a lot of the population throughout the region. So some of the gaps you see are really rural areas where there aren't many people, and that's why we didn't get a big response from those areas. So again, you'll see these responses to the individual questions as we bring up the tasks that they pertain to. But if there aren't any questions on this, I can pass it on to Connor.
I've got a quick comment. Mm-hmm. So just so the group knows, she talked a lot about the participation from municipalities. So the group, we are actually adding another seat for large municipalities. So we've already are representing municipalities as a whole, but now we're going to break it into municipalities less than 25,000 and municipalities over 25,000. And that's actually a seat. So we're looking for large municipality now, and that is actually out being advertised.
due May 30th.
And due May 30th. So if y'all know, if the group knows of anybody that would like to represent large municipalities, we want to get their application in by May 30th. Thank you. Sorry.
So last meeting, we talked about introducing the public roadshow. I think it'd be good to start planning on where we want to have these public roadshows for the new members. What we did last cycle, we went to various areas of the region. I think we went to five different locations within the region, and we created hosted a open house forum where we presented what's going on with our regional flood planning efforts, and then had breakout sessions where we just intermingled, I guess, with some of the local officials in that region and just try to get understanding of what their flood risk is and educate the public on what we're doing here. And so I think it'd be good for us to, you know, like I mentioned last cycle, to get a head start on that and get something planned and on the books for later this year before we do this technical memo. And as we are finishing up processing some of this data, such as the flood quilt and pulling in all these FMXs, the studies and projects, getting that in front of the public early so that they can give us comments and feedback on whether they agree or they want to add stuff to the flood plan. So y'all had several questions last time for Connor, and we went through those and addressed those, and Connor's going to kind of provide an update on where we're at with all that.
Thanks, Ryan. Yeah, so like Ryan said, you know, this is the slides that we have here today are, you know, specifically addressing the concerns and questions that we received during last month's meeting. I do want to point out that, you know, in April's meeting, we did provide a more of a comprehensive overview of our proposed roadshow plan. And then the meeting materials posted on the website, there is a document, a roadshow planning document that has more detail in it than even what was presented, you know, in a summary format during last month's meeting. So, you know, I encourage y'all to please check that out. It may address any questions. And of course, if you have any today, I'd be happy to answer those. But a couple of the key points that were brought up during April's meeting were in the time frame that we're looking at for our roadshow, late August, early September. You know, how does that potentially conflict with the start of the new school year in each of these locations? So we did take a look at that. Those school year start dates in each of our proposed roadshow meeting locations are listed there. And so we are proposing to start with our first roadshow here in Waco at BRA on the 21st. And that's about a week after the start of the new year in each of these different ISDs. So we don't believe that starting a roadshow will conflict with, you know, the hustle and bustle that is the start of the new school year in all of these locations. The other point that was brought up was hurricane season risk. Of course, in the time frame we're looking at, we can't completely avoid risk from potential hurricanes. But what we have done and have changed up since we met with y'all last is we are flipping locations in our schedule. So the lower basin meetings would be occurring before the upper basin meetings. So here on this slide, this is an update to what we presented last time. Here you can see we flipped College Station and Rosenberg up into late August, including those Granbury and Georgetown meetings into September. So again, we'd be starting here in Waco on the 21st, doing the lower basin meetings the following week in August. We are proposing to avoid the week of Labor Day entirely. We know folks tend to travel around, you know, that holiday, capitalize on that opportunity. So we're proposing to avoid that and then pick up back with the upper basin the following week with Granbury and Georgetown. The last thing here today is I know there were several follow-up questions on the proposed virtual meeting format. And again, this isn't noted on any of the slides, but we are proposing to, in addition to the five in-person roadshow meetings, conduct a virtual meeting following those in-person meetings. And the logic behind that is that we don't want to discourage anyone from joining us for those in-person meetings, but we also understand people have very busy schedules. We want to provide that opportunity if for whatever reason they can't make it out to us in person. And so that's the logic behind having it at the end after all the in-person meetings. But I did want to walk through our proposed format in a little bit more detail, and I'm, again, happy to answer any questions. I'm going to try to do this as clearly and concisely as I can, and this table here on the slide is intended to help you kind of visualize how this would work. So this format that we're proposing is not a presentation-focused format. What we're trying to do here is replicate an in-person, open house, come-and-go format as close as we possibly can in this virtual setting. How this would start is a welcome and introduction and orientation. So we wouldn't be presenting any technical information, anything that we're up to as far as the planning cycle. This is really a, hey, this is how the meeting is structured. This is how it will flow. Also, you know, here are the ground rules for the meeting today. A concern that I completely understand is in this format, there's not as much control by the meeting facilitators in a typical presentation focused format. So we do lay out ground rules very clearly, in this orientation, so that attendees know that this isn't a free for all. There are steps that we will take to remove people from the meeting if they don't follow and adhere to these ground rules. Following that orientation, that walkthrough of how the flow would work, we would then open out into our first breakout session. And so when that first breakout session opens, we are not, I'm sure everyone at this point is familiar with how breakout sessions work. In most cases, you are put into a breakout room by the meeting facilitator. In this case, that option is given to the attendee. And so they're free to choose which station in that first breakout session that they want to jump into. And so, if they're particularly interested in the subject matter in station three, they can jump right into that station, in breakout session one. And then, if they have more questions on that topic, they can jump back into that station in breakout session two. But just to back up, breakout session one, this would be, we still need to, determine exactly how long these would be. In the past, we've done them for, 20 minutes or so. But within each breakout session, there would be, of course, our subject matter experts in there providing a brief presentation on that, whatever that topic may be, followed by an open Q&A session. And so this is intended to, again, replicate that open house format, provide attendees with, more opportunities to interact on kind of a one-on-one level with our subject matter experts. Once that breakout session, ends, everyone is flowed back into the main lobby. We announce the start of breakout session two, and then that cycle continues. So the attendees have the freedom to, jump to whatever station. They could go in order if they so choose. They could, focus on just a couple stations or, all of or just one to get the questions that they have answered.
Let's see. We have a question.
I'll pause.
If you could pause for a second. Any other questions? I saw Russell popped up for a minute. Did you have a question, Russell?
No, sir. I was just typing the message in there saying that I have to get off for our event, and I look forward to watching the recording. So I didn't mean to interrupt with that. I sent an email to Pamela, and I wanted to put it in the text.
No problem. I just saw your name pop up on the board, so I didn't know. I didn't
yes,
realize
sir.
Just a comment. All right. Well, thank
yes,
you.
Yes, sir.
Right.
It was just a comment. Thank y'all. Have a great day. Thank y'all.
Go ahead.
I'm just going to pause there for any questions. That's everything that I wanted to run through. I hope that was clear.
Yeah. If there's no questions, we'll just proceed with the current dates and locations and the virtual meeting format. So he had mentioned that the plan is on the website, I guess. I gave it to y'all as a supplemental, so y'all should have that in PDF format if y'all want to take a closer look and deeper dive on what the details are for this outreach plan. So
I got just a quick, how are we advertising that these meetings are going to take place?
Sure. my hidden slide pulled up. We're proposing to essentially follow the same approach that happened last time. And so that's newspaper advertisements, direct emails, direct mail, both at a region-wide level, advertising, you know, all of the meetings that we have planned, and then more targeted, specific direct notices, you know, for the stakeholders, you know, that are closer to those specific meeting locations.
You know, public announcements are free on the radio, and I don't know if that would be something y'all would want to pursue or not, but sure. I know for the radio, if it's a public announcement, there's no cost in it. And I know we had talked about it briefly last time, and somebody had made the comment, well, we don't really have the budget for buying radio time. But something to consider.
Well, there's no questions. We'll move into task 2B, get an update on that. So last time we had talked, what this is basically we're developing two flood risk layers. We're taking results from different modeling, FEMA, community models, Texas BLE, and developing a flood quilt that gives us a comprehensive understanding of what the flood risk is over a whole region. Task 2B is an extension of that where we're looking at future conditions. So it's the same type of process, but we're looking at future land use changes, changes in rainfall, changes in sea level rise, and developing a projected a flood quilt that anticipates future flood risk. So I'll give it over to Nick. He'll give you an update on some of the things that we found out since the last meeting.
Thanks, Ryan. You can move to the next slide, please. So like Ryan said, we touched on this, introduced the topic in the last meeting. And today our goal is to really kind of finalize an approach so we can get started in earnest on task 2B. And so for the exposure and vulnerability analysis in future conditions, we made this recommendation in the last meeting, but just to recap, what we intend to do for future conditions is update our buildings layer using state water plan census block population projections to anticipate the location that future residential development is likely to occur. And then we take the future flood hazard layer and we intersect that with the future buildings layer to calculate the exposure and vulnerability metrics. Next slide, please. We presented these two options in the last meeting, and really what we're going to recommend today is option two with a few refinements to that approach based on our review of Fathom data. So reviewing Fathom data, we noticed some issues with the results, which did lead us to option two. And like I said, that blue text does indicate some refinements to our approach. So we intend to use best available data for a given location in the watershed. We plan to use the Fathom future rainfall adjustments, but then develop our own future land cover data set using outputs from the future development tool that I mentioned in the previous slide for the exposure analysis. So using those assumptions, we plan to perform simplified updates to the best available model data. And in our prioritization framework that is fairly consistent with task 2A, we've included 1D BLE in that prioritization, and we plan to post-process those 1D BLE results using a vertical buffer technique, which I'll explain a little bit more in the next slide. So the image on the right side of the screen shows our approach for implementing vertical buffers on 1D BLE data. We plan to compare 1D BLE to future Fathom data to determine where we plan to leverage 1D BLE and where we plan to leverage the future Fathom data. And where we do decide to use the 1D BLE data, we plan to take the difference between existing and future Fathom data and apply that to 1D BLE data in the form of a vertical buffer. And then for accounting for the future development, we're planning to limit these limit the updates to account for future development to just simply updating impervious cover layers and reference information for the models that we are recomputing for future conditions. And additionally, the full report, like Ryan mentioned earlier, the full report of Fathom has been provided, which includes the rainfall adjustments. And for these rainfall adjustments that we then take and apply to our models, we plan to use the upper the upper percentile precipitation increase that they present in their report.
Let me get a question.
Sure.
Sujeet, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Nick, in terms of the future development, are you, I understand you're going to be using the state maps or something, but additionally, is there something like the current ratio, whatever it is, the factor, is that your starting point? If your census looks different from the current patterns, what you've seen, the ratios, is there something you're going to be planning, adjusting, and documenting the same?
Yes, yeah, we would plan to take the whatever baseline data is being used in the models and make that upward adjustment to that information, obviously capping the increase at like 100% impervious cover.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Next slide, please. So like I mentioned previously, we do intend to review the Fathom and 1D BLE data in a little bit more detail because there are some areas where we see the Fathom data offering advantages over BLE. And one example of that is in urbanized areas like College Station. This flooding source, the BLE data that is shown in blue, is not covering the full floodplain corridor that is in this like undeveloped floodplain area. And from detailed modeling that our group has performed in this area, we concluded that the Fathom data matches this information more closely. And so this generally has us leaning toward using pluvial Fathom data over BLE in areas like this or areas where there's very small contributing areas. Next slide, please. And then conversely, in a more like a fluvial example with a large contributing drainage area, this is the Navasota River. We generally see that 1D BLE depths are much higher than Fathom depths. And so based on there being more documentation provided and more like more consideration of local geographies with BLE data, whereas Fathom is more of like a very high level statewide effort, we intend to leverage BLE for these larger flooding sources. Next slide, please. And so just to summarize our overall approach, we plan to compute regional scale 2D models, and this is primarily like 2D BLE and GLO models with updated precipitation and land cover data. And when we say regional scale, this is roughly like a HUC 10 size model, because we want to like have our effort go a long way. If we're updating a model and rerunning it, if it covers a large geographic area, that's easier to fit within our budget for this task. And then next, we plan to apply a vertical buffer technique to select 1D BLE areas using the Fathom Scenario 3 is supporting data. And so we would, like I mentioned, compare Fathom Scenario 3, which is shown on that table is the significant rainfall adjustment for future conditions. Compare that back to existing conditions, find the difference, and apply it to the 1D BLE data. And then lastly, we plan to use fluvial fathom data where we don't have any other data covering certain areas. And for this, we would plan to use scenario 4, since we didn't see the issues associated with the land cover data in this scenario. Ideally, we would be able to use scenario 3, but based on our review, we saw inconsistent changes from existing to future conditions in scenario 3 as a result of updated land cover layers.
Can I summarize?
Sure.
For the non-engineers and for like the new members, you don't really know some of the backstory on this. We've covered this in past meetings, but the state Texas Water Development Board has developed some modeling for the whole state of Texas called Fathom, or using a company called Fathom to understand what future flood risk would be for the entire state. They're very high-level models, and they asked us to use these models for this flood planning effort, but we are welcome to use other methods if y'all want to go with another approach or a different method. We did take a look at the Fathom data. I appreciate Nick's work on doing that for us. There was just some issues with the land use, particularly that as far as like impervious cover and the roughness that we think skewed the results in a lot of different places. And we just weren't really comfortable with the final product. But what we're planning to do is just take the good stuff from Fathom and plug it into these high-level, base-level engineering models, which we have a lot more trust. We understand how the BLE models were developed. We're comfortable working with them. Whereas Fathom, we don't know how they were built. We can't really work with them. So we want to pull the data from Fathom and plug it into these other types of models. And I think it will give us really consistent results that are consistent with our existing flood risk layer as well. So that's why we're kind of going with this. It seems overly complicated. It's not for us engineers, but I think it's a good approach just to make sure we're consistent between existing and future conditions. And we're proposing to go with this alternative approach. We'll probably send this to Texas Water Development Board to get their approval. And we're not the only region doing this. I know our neighboring regions are considering similar approaches. That is the Trinity and the Lower Colorado, and even the San Jacinto potentially. They all have their own unique data sources and unique challenges. But I think there's kind of a unanimous concern, I guess, with the Fathom data, where some regions are going to use it because that's all they've got. But others are gonna use what we can, and we're not getting rid of Fathom completely. We're gonna use it. We're just deprioritizing it to where we're not putting all of our eggs in that basket, essentially. So hopefully that kind of.
Thanks for that clarification. Yeah. Yes.
And to add to that, the Water Development Board in their technical guidelines, they do mention, you know, leveraging better quality data, but like you said, we'll just be communicating that to the Water Development Board and getting their approval of the approach per the technical guidelines.
Any comments or questions?
I don't see any.
Cool. Well, we'll move forward with that, Rick, with that scenario. The next task, I wanted to introduce this. This was a task that's kind of been on hold pending our community questionnaire. And now that we've completed the questionnaire, we got some valuable feedback. This is really dependent on getting feedback from communities. So we brought on Torres to help lead this effort. And I'll just let y'all introduce it. So, yeah.
Yeah. Good morning. I'm Evan Adrian. I'm a junior project engineer with Torres and Associates. We're going to provide a kind of a brief introduction to Task 3A, provide a recap on what we did in the previous regional flood plan, and then provide some of the survey results preliminarily that that kind of apply to this task and give kind of an insight on what the communities are seeing and kind of thinking in regard to this task.
Can you speak up just a little bit more?
Yes. Can y'all hear me better?
Yes, there you go.
All right, perfect. As part of Task 3A, we do a lot of data collection. We collect input from the communities. We define targets that we want our standards to kind of meet. We conduct the assessment, and then with all of that information, all of that input, we develop standards that we bring to the regional flood planning group to recommend. Next slide. So we've evaluated information from existing databases and from the stakeholder discovery process. That's the community questionnaire that we just received the information from. From that information, we develop generalizations on floodplain management practices, the flood risks in the area, and then the impact of the flood in the area. We also develop a table that kind of summarizes a lot of this information, and that is provided in the flood plan. Next slide. The good news in this region is almost all of the communities regulate within the floodplain. It's a good benefit for the citizens. It includes cost savings, and most of the communities are regulating to the minimum standards, with 95% of the counties participating in the National Flood Insurance Program and 84% of the municipalities participating. And there's a map that kind of shows the general. As part of Task 3A, we go through, look at the floodplain practices throughout the region, try to identify gaps in standards policies, quantify the risk reduction, look at failing infrastructure, see where there is flood warning, flood response, where people are implementing floodplain protection. And then we also leverage some results from Task 2B to see kind of how the flood risk changes over time. We also look to identify issues within the region. The Lower Brazos region is large. The flood risk varies between the coast all the way up to the Middle Brazos region. There's different issues that we've kind of identified and tried to address with our standards. So next slide. This kind of gives an overall process for developing the standards. Step one is collecting the information, summarizing the common themes. The next step is to bring these standards to the regional flood planning group for discussion. And then once we discuss with the regional flood planning group, we refine those standards, and then the group decides on adopting or recommending these region-wide standards. Next slide. So these standards, there's kind of two ways to go about it. One is recommending these standards to all of the entities in the region, which recommending is basically means that there's no restrictions on forcing these entities to adopt some of these regulations or standards. So as part of this, if we choose to adopt these standards, basically establishing a standard, all of the jurisdictions must meet that standard before one of their flood management evaluations, flood mitigation strategy, or flood mitigation project can be included in the plan. So basically, if the regional flood planning group chooses to adopt a standard, all of the entities in the region that want to be considered for one of the FME, FMS, or FMPs
have to abide by that standard before they can be included in the plan.
Okay, we got a question. Sujeet?
Yes.
Thank you, Chair. Ryan, you have about 16% of the municipalities are not in the NIFP, right? Your earlier slide right there?
Yes, correct.
So are there any flood losses in those 16% of the communities? Any documented?
I don't know. I don't even know if that would be documented since they're not in an FIP. But I can't tell you a number.
Okay. Maybe down the line, if you can see, there may be a reason why they want to be part of NIFP, because they may not see any damages.
Did y'all get any feedback on those two communities? You know, or something maybe we can look at? And look at
that we got some feedback from Falls County that we can look at.
Okay.
Thank you.
We'll definitely check on that.
Okay.
Thank you.
I just, while we're parked here, I wanted to say that the last cycle, we only recommended standard. We didn't adopt any. I think there was a concern about being too strict. If we come in and say you have to have these standards, then we're not going to include your projects in the state flood plan. I think the consensus was that was too strict. But there's still the option this cycle. If there are standards that we come up with that we want to adopt, well, if you adopt those, and they must adopt those standards before we'll include FMXs, like Evan was saying. We're also talking about you don't have to adopt all of them. There might be a few. I don't know if you talk about this.
Right. I think I've got a slide later on that.
Well, I'll let you explain it this morning.
We kind of developed, so we have the standards from the previous cycle. And then we were kind of thinking, how do we get, we have these standards, but how do we get these entities to kind of pursue some of these standards? So one way is we have the potential to adopt the select standards. You have the ability to select only a few of the standards for adoption while keeping maybe more strict ones as recommended. That's an option for the RFPG. So that is one way that we can kind of push some of these entities to adopt or to achieve some of these minimum standards. We can also develop and disperse some guidance for these entities to try and achieve these standards. So basically giving them a roadmap on how do we get to some of these minimum standards and what does some of that process mean. And then we can also reach out to these entities to sponsor an FME or an FMS that aims to achieve these minimum standards as part of Task 4A. And kind of an example as the NFIP participation flowchart just kind of gives them a roadmap on this is what you can do to get to these minimum standards. Next slide. Now we're going to go through a quick recap on Task 3A from the previous RFP cycle. As part of Task 3A, we broke our recommended standards into both region-wide standards that basically encompass the entire area, and they were all recommendations. No standards were adopted in the previous cycle. And then we also developed zone-specific recommendations because the region does vary pretty greatly between rainfall, topography, land use, all of that varies pretty widely across the region. Next slide. For the recommended standards that were region-wide, these were kind of more general standards, like NFIP participation, providing compensatory storage in the 1% floodplain, so the 100-year floodplain, no adverse impacts for the 100-year storm event, improving flood response, and improved flood risk awareness and education. Some of these are more general recommended standards so that entities could look at this and kind of tailor it to their specific needs, especially like the improved flood response. It might look different for different entities. And then we also have recommended standards based on zone. You can kind of see a breakdown of
which zones have which standards kind of applied to them. So some of them have the use of best available rainfall data. Currently, that is Atlas 14, but we wanted to keep it kind of general because rainfall is always changing. There could be a future rainfall data set that could be used as best available. Kind of becoming more building on a region-wide standard for no adverse impacts in the 1% and 10% storm event. So just kind of a step above on that standard. Formation of a voluntary buyout program. In some of these areas, there's a lot of historic flood claims. So formation of that voluntary buyout program might help prevent some of that flood loss in those areas. Development of long-term operation and maintenance planning for drainage infrastructure. Drainage infrastructure is aging and it does need kind of continual maintenance. So recommending that for some of these areas. Drainage corridor preservation. In some of these areas that have a little bit less development around the drainage corridor, recommending to preserve that so that we don't lose any of that corridor for rainfall, basically so that we don't exacerbate the flooding in those areas. The next one, compensatory storage requirement and the 0.2% floodplain, so the 500-year floodplain, is just kind of a step above the region-wide standard. Requirements for culverts and bridge crossings. This standard is more for requiring them to be sized for a 1% AEP storm event. That's just a little bit more restrictive and will help prevent some of the low water crossings that are in some of these areas. Roadway requirements within the floodplain is basically elevating the roadway above the base flood elevation to get to kind of on single access roadways or roadways to critical facilities. That way that there's always an access road to these areas. And the last one is culvert and bridge hydrologic and hydraulic analysis, basically requiring a detailed analysis for new bridges and new culverts. Next slide. And if you do have any questions, feel free to ask them as they come. And then to just kind of go over a few of the community questionnaire results. This first one is during the first cycle of regional flood planning, we developed the minimum standards for the region. And it basically asked the entities if they agreed with the floodplain management standards or if they didn't. Based on the results, most of the ones that replied either yes or no did say yes, that they agreed. There are a few that disagreed with some of the standards. We do plan on reaching out to these entities to kind of get some feedback from them, see what they might have agreed with, what they might have had some concern about. But overall, it seemed like most of the entities did agree with the floodplain management standards. Next slide. This next question is about adopting or requiring consistent minimum standards across the region. This goes back to the adopt versus recommend question. It's pretty close to about half said yes and about half said no, with a little bit more leaning towards the yes category. But I just kind of wanted to present that. And then the last question is, should the RFPG recommend any of the following minimum standards for all jurisdictions within the region? And overwhelmingly, there is a recommendation for regulating development in the FEMA floodplain. Drainage corridor preservation is up there. Developing detention standards. Basically, this question will review
and kind of tailor some of the standards a little bit more, see if there's one standard that we can look at adding. Maybe it's revising a detention standard or something like that, basically using this information to help us refine the standards that we have. So just wanted to provide a quick summary. I know that was a a lot of information to kind of go through regarding Task 3A. We do have the potential to adopt select standards. We have an opportunity to utilize Task 4A to help these entities achieve some of these minimum standards. And a majority of the survey responses did support kind of the recommended standards in the 2023 regional flood plan. As part of the next steps, we want to revisit the standards for recommendation, refine them as needed based on any of the new information that we've received. And if we choose to adopt certain standards, we'll go through, develop some supporting information with recommendations for which standards to adopt. And I guess this is kind of a question for the regional flood planning group on whether or not to look to adopt these adopt certain standards, or if the consensus is to kind of keep with the same method that we had in the 2023 regional flood plan of just recommending these standards.
So I think the overall plan is to bring this back either next meeting or two meetings from now, based off the feedback that y'all provide. I would be curious to know if there is any desire to adopt any standards, or if you just want to go with the old approach of just doing a recommendation. It doesn't do anything. It's just saying, hey, as a region, we recommend this list of these lists of recommendations. But if there's some that we want, you want us to explore more, some recommendations you don't like, or if there are specific ones that you want us to adopt, well, now we can go back and do our homework on how, adding, removing, or updating to for adoption.
Ryan, we got some questions from the group. We'll do Sujeeth, and then Charlotte, and then Matt. Go ahead, Sujeeth.
Thank you, Chair. I think, I would say that one, keeping the standard the same as last one is the best approach. We keep on moving the goalposts, we'll be never there. Again, recommended standards, and maybe if we need to go far, higher than that, we can say a different word terminology and let it go. That's my take.
Thank you, CG. Charlotte?
Yes, CG, that was pretty much in line with echoing you. I mean, I think it would be great for us to continue to develop suggested or recommended standards, but really stop hard and not adopt, not require that to be adopted by the local entities in order to have projects move into the state plan. There's just too much at a local level that that I think is not necessarily the right step for us to be in the middle of, at least at this point within the statewide flood planning efforts.
Matt.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to be a little repetitive, but I think I said this when we addressed this issue last time, and I just don't know if I did or not, but I think that, you know, us adopting standards puts us in a role that I don't think is appropriate for the planning group. I think that, you know, requiring standards that determine whether or not you're able to bring in the regional plan and the state plan and control your access to funding is really a role that's more appropriately taken on by the Water Development Board in their rulemaking, or even by the legislature itself. I don't know that that's the role of our planning group to dictate that. So that would be my two cents.
Sounds like we'll move forward with looking at our old recommendations and seeing if there's small tweaks we can make to improve the wording or whatever, but it doesn't sound like we'll bring any back for adoption. But we'll have that final discussion to next meeting.
Brian, sorry, I just wanted to add one more thing. it looked like on the map for, and I was looking at the slides on my other screen too, like for how many, we just didn't have a lot of participation saying yes, no, I don't know. So if we're still going to try to increase that participation by all of the counties and municipalities that have projects, et cetera, within the plan, is that correct? Or can you guys speak to that at all, how we will increase that participation in order to help hone these recommendations?
Talking about, was that the
community questionnaire 3A results? Like, there's just, they're not, if I look at the map for what's highlighted, it's not overwhelming, the participation.
Yeah, I guess that tells us that they didn't know what our recommendations were. I don't think that was actually in the questionnaire either, as far as the list.
We did. We provided the table. Yeah.
Okay, so the table was in that questionnaire, Charlotte, or of recommendations. So they would have seen that whenever they put this.
Yeah, let me rephrase what I'm saying. Of the yes, no, I don't know. There's, I don't know in total here, how many of the counties are even highlighted from having responded, period. Because that's what I'm getting at. So... there was a comment made that the team was going to go back and just try to understand, for those who said yes, what did they like, you know, for those who said no, what didn't they like, etc. Well, that's all good information for us to have. It's just we're still not getting a very high participation on this, and that would be needed for me to really even take notice of any questionnaire results like this. But it still doesn't change what I was saying. I don't think we should be adopting, but I think it's important so that we can hone the recommendations.
Yeah, I think community questionnaire participation has been a big struggle for us, more so last cycle. I think we've seen an improvement this cycle. I think we've had some lessons learned. And I think just moving over to the next cycle, we'll just have to continue to improve every cycle, figure out better ways. I mean, we emailed, called, left voicemails, emailed again, sent out flyers. Maybe next cycle we can think about other strategies to kind of learn, see what communities are we missing, which counties are we missing? Is it rural? Do they not really have issues and that's why they're not participating? Are we just not reaching them well? So that's definitely something that we'll look into this cycle as far as recommendations for next cycle for sure. So. But I agree. It's always, there's always room for improvement for getting more participation. So.
Okay. Thank you.
And then the last one I'll be covering, Task 4A. This is really brief. I just wanted to introduce it because next group meeting we'll be presenting this matrix. So we've already talked about Task 4A a lot with the amendment. This is just us collecting FMXs. So that's the floodplain management evaluations, flood mitigation projects and flood mitigation strategies, studies, construction projects, or strategies. We've done a lot of collection in the amendment process, but we're continuing that effort, and we're trying to get anything that was missed during the amendment that we did at the end of last year. But what's different now, though, is that we can, I guess, clean out some old FMXs and come up with more criteria for what we allow into the plan and not in the plan. So this is just really the collection effort at this point, though. We're not really evaluating or recommending FMXs. This is just the collection effort. And that's what our main focus is. Now that we close out the questionnaire, we've gotten some feedback from some communities saying, hey, here are some of our projects. We're collecting those. We're going to start doing online research to see if there's any other projects or studies that communities want. And we'll coordinate them to include those into the flood plan. So that's what we're starting now. Just wanted to let y'all know. If you go to the next slide, I think I've already talked about all this, but one of the things I wanted to know, one of the new things that we're doing is this FMX form. I think this was Anthony Beach's recommendation. I appreciate that. It gives them, we can send this out to communities and they can fill out the form. It's really just a first introduction. It's like, hey, what are there any projects or studies that you want in the flood plan? They can fill this out really quickly, send it back to us, and this gives us a really good first understanding of what they need, and then we'll reach back out to them. Asking for a little bit more information based off of what they submit Because based off of FMP, we need different types of information. So this is just kind of a first pass, and we've had some good success with this already with the amendment and with the questionnaire. So looking forward to using this tool. Go to the next slide. What we're going to bring up next time is this matrix. What we're doing is we're getting, like, we're gathering as much information as we can as far as the needs that are out there. But we have to process it and drop them into different types of buckets. If it's an FME, that is a study, or FMP, or if an FMS, we kind of have to outline the process. We'll do this. So we'll probably process hundreds, if not maybe over 1,000 FMSs through this matrix and drop them in the individual buckets. And then we'll also use this matrix. And one of the things we're going to introduce next time is an approach for removing things out of the plan, really old stuff that no one cares about, essentially. So we'll take FMXs from the previous state flood plan. We'll also get any new information we get from communities, and we'll process it again and figure out what needs to be discarded and not included whatsoever, or what can actually potentially be a project, study, or strategy for us to consider for recommendation during task five. So I just want to introduce that to y'all and let y'all know it's coming up at the next meeting, and we'll discuss it and make, y'all have to make a recommendation on this matrix then. So just kind of keep that in on your radar. Any questions on that? Okay. And then the final slide, just give y'all an overview of what's coming up. In June, we're going to talk about goals. I'm going to introduce the goals, and then Task 4A, we'll talk about this matrix. We may give you some updates on some of the other tasks that are ongoing as needed. And we may even talk about performing FMEs, which is Task 4C. Again, this cycle, we have the ability, we have a bucket of money for our technical consultant team to actually go and perform studies throughout the region. And we can actually go and get started on that if we wanted to. So we may bring that back in June. And then July, we should have the task one chapter complete for y'all to look at. And then task 2A, the flood quilt, we'll have that ready for y'all in draft form to review. And then task 3A, we'll bring the recommendations back for y'all to review either June or July. I guess we'll coordinate on that. And then task 3B is flood mitigation needs analysis. We'll introduce that task. So that's kind of the plan for the next two meetings. With that, that's all I have. Is there some questions?
Are you going to bring those FMEs to the room for us to prioritize?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's going to be a whole discussion. So that's why I'm thinking maybe June. So if you don't have very many items, it might be good for that, because there might be some discussion we need to have there. We'll bring some of the ones that we recommend. We're going to have to do a prioritization. We had a whole discussion on it last cycle. We'll do the same.
I don't see any other questions.